Hello, I'm Will Stein, and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 Desert Island Disc series, whereby each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book, and luxury item they would want to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in the podcast. You can find links to the 8 songs on the LSE Geography and Environment website. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Geography Island Jams. My guest for this episode is Tom Smith. Tom is an environmental scientist specialising in interdisciplinary approaches to understanding the role of biomass burning in the Earth system. His research focuses on greenhouse gas and reactive emissions from wildland fires in savannas and tropical peatlands. Tom is undergraduate tutor in the Geography and Environment Department. He is also the course director for the undergraduate environment programs. Before coming to the LSE, Tom did his undergraduate degree in physical geography at the University of Sheffield, followed by his master's in environmental monitoring, modelling and management, and he did a PhD in improving estimates of biomass burning using open-path FTIR spectroscopy at King's College. Tom was born and grew up in Birmingham and was the first in his family to go to university. Outside of the LSE, Tom has an eclectic range of skills and interests. These include singing, he is beyond a grade 8 standard. Running, he has completed a half marathon with Felipe Carosi. He's a firefighter, as he is a qualified wildfire firefighter. And finally, he's also a photographer. Whilst taking a range of pictures, he's had a number of his photos of rugby games published in his local magazines. So welcome, Tom.
Hi, Will.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you're a grade 8 singer, also a great pianist, which I didn't mention, but do you play any other instruments?
I, over the years, have picked up many different instruments, and I suppose I lack the discipline to keep at it. So I've tried to play the trombone, the cello, I have a guitar, and I can play some chords on the guitar, normally just to kind of accompany a singer or something like that. But I've never really got to any decent standard, apart from on the piano and with singing as well.
So what grade are you on the piano?
I got up to grade 7 on the piano. Again, wow. Just don't have the discipline to really push for that grade 8. But I do have my grade 8 in singing, but I would say that comes more naturally to me than kind of having to do lots and lots of practice on these other more difficult instruments.
So how long have you been singing for?
Well, I did A-level in music. And for the A-level in music, you have to do performance, history of music, composition, things like that. And for my performance, I was always going to play the piano because I thought that was my best instrument. And my music teacher at the time realized that I had quite a strong voice. I was in the choir, and she encouraged me to take singing lessons, and because she felt that my performance on the A level might be better if I actually sang rather than played the piano. So I was a little bit kind of dejected that my piano playing skills were not appreciated, but she really pushed me, and I have really fond memories of this music teacher. She kind of was quite a good kind of mentor, not just in my A level in music, but in the kind of wider sphere of school, I would say. And I took some singing lessons, and within a year I managed to get my grade 8 in singing, and I was using those pieces as my performance pieces from my A-level in music.
So now, can you tell me about the music? What's the first song you're going to be taking with you?
Yeah, the first song is quite a sad song, really. It's by The Carpenters, and when I was growing up in Birmingham, it wasn't an easy time. I lived with my mum and my younger sister in quite a small flat on a housing estate in Birmingham. My parents divorced when I was quite young. And my mum would play The Carpenters a lot. And if you know The Carpenters, it's fairly depressing material, I would say. But I absolutely fell in love with Karen Carpenter's voice. It's just, she has an incredible range. She really hits the low notes. And you can just tell it's full of emotion, and I could have picked a number of Carpenter songs, but the song Solitaire, I suppose, is about someone living alone, someone who's lost love, and I think maybe there was like elements of me thinking about my family at the time when listening to these songs as a young boy. also, you know, it's quite depressing really, but having fallen in love with this woman's voice, I remember being absolutely devastated when my mum told me that she died young and had died before I was born. So I always kind of get fairly kind of tearful or emotional listening to these songs.
As you mentioned, you grew up in Birmingham. Whereabouts in Birmingham did you grow up?
So I grew up in the suburbs on the eastern side of Birmingham. It was a place called Warmley. Most people haven't heard of it, but it's kind of difficult to describe. On one side of the housing estate, there were fields, open fields, and the other side of the housing estate was Birmingham. So I really was on the edge of the city. And it was quite a nice place to grow up because there was a lot of green space. I was given a lot of freedom to kind of explore, leave the house by myself, ride around on my bike, meet up with friends from school. So that was quite nice, being outdoors, and I suppose having lots of opportunities to exercise and play football, play cricket with friends. So on the eastern side of Birmingham, I went to a grammar school near the city centre. It was about a kind of 45-minute bus ride to get to school every morning. So lots of early wake-ups.
And do you have any funny or mischievous stories from your time growing up in Birmingham?
Ooh, yeah, quite a few. I'm not too sure how many I could share on here. I mean, I liked climbing trees, but that's not particularly mischievous. It's a bit like Theresa May's running in the fields. There was one story where when I was kind of 17, 18, we used to go to the local pub on the housing estate called the Oak and Ash. And we dared not go in the kind of the bar area. We'd always sit in the lounge where it was a bit quieter. But after a long night of catching up with some friends, we decided to race to the oak tree. So the pub was called the Oak and Ash after two trees that were on the field next to the pub. And I took the racing quite seriously, I would say, very competitive. And I remember looking back over my shoulder to see how far ahead I was of my two friends, and then proceeded to run straight into the tree. And I was quite lucky that I didn't severely damage my eye or something, because I ran into a branch that was sticking out the side, and ended up being badly grazed. And I remember having to go to work the next morning at the local supermarket. I worked on a checkout with a massive graze across my forehead, and lots of questions from the customers that day.
Moving on to your second song, can you tell me what it is and if there's any reasons why?
Yeah, so this is Louis Armstrong and His Hot Five with Earl Hines playing the piano. It's a 1928 recording, so it goes back a long, long time. It's incredible listening to these pieces now that are almost 100 years old. This was, I can't remember whether it was a case study on either my GCSE or A-level in music. I'm not too sure when I first listened to this, but it really kind of changed the way I looked at playing the piano. I suppose mostly I'd kind of learned classical pieces and I'd gone through and done my grades. And listening to Earl Hines, who's the pianist on this track, playing like piano solos, jazz piano, his improvisation over the top of 12 bar blues, which I'd only really been introduced to through my GCSE in music, I think, really kind of made me think about the piano differently. I was like, I want to learn how to improvise. I want to learn how to just be able to kind of just turn up, play some chords and play something really cool over the top. And from then on, I pretty much gave up with piano lessons and started just teaching myself how to improvise, how to use chord sequences, 12 bar blues, things like this. So it's a great track. And, you know, I mentioned Earl Hines many times. Louis Armstrong is obviously the leader of the band, very important in the development of blues at that time. I suppose I always wanted to play the trumpet as well, another instrument, but again, never really had the discipline to really kind of get through to it. If I could like suddenly be able to play one instrument really, really well, it would be the trumpet. So always admired Louis Armstrong. And also he sings a little bit in this song, in this recording as well. And it's just, there are no words. It's just kind of improvised singing. And I think it's really, I really like the voice as an instrument, not just, you know, as a conveyor of words. And Louis Armstrong does this really well in this particular recording of West End Blues.
So as well as lecturing and teaching in the department, you're also the departmental tutor. For those who aren't familiar, can you tell me a bit more about what the role entails?
Well, I've been in this role for about 10 months now, and even I'm still learning the many different things that this role entails, because different things crop up at different times of the year, depending on where we are in the administration side of things. So the very first thing I had to do was, it was the course choice window at the start of the academic year, and a lot of students decide to do things that are slightly outside of the regulations. They want to suspend regulations. They want to take a course that isn't listed on the paper that they're supposed to take. And so all of that comes to me. It's firstly, you know, approved by the academic mentor, but then it's the departmental tutor who has to make sure that everything is by the book and by the regulations. And so in a way, I've had to develop a kind of details approach to administration, which I wasn't used to before. It's very, very important that you get the details right. And it's something that I've appreciated with this job, is actually taking time to make sure that you understand all of the rules and regulations, of which there are many, and finding all of the correct PDF documents on the LSE website, which is also a task in itself. So yeah, there's course changes, there's the class group changes. Every time that a student wants to make a class group change, that comes to the departmental tutor as well. Right now, I'm having to deal with the in-year resit deferral and assessment period, making sure that students are aware of what it means if they deferred an assessment, of which quite a few students this year have deferred assessments. And what it means for their progression into the second year and the third year, and ultimately down the line to classification as well. Often I'm the person to turn to when mentors are not sure about questions. So again, at the moment I'm dealing with students who are thinking about their course choices for next year, and the mentor's not too sure about what is allowed and what isn't allowed. So I'm having to kind of advise the mentors as well. I mean, ultimately, my job is made massively easier by having such great colleagues who are good mentors. So in a lot of our other departments at the LSE, the departmental tutor has a much bigger role, because lots of students go straight to their departmental tutor, straight to the director of undergraduate studies. But we have really great mentors, all of the academic staff are mentors to our students. And normally things are resolved at the mentor stage before it comes to me. So actually my colleagues make this job much easier than it could be.
Anything you enjoy most about the role?
What I've enjoyed most about the role is actually I get to go to these, this sounds terrible saying that I really enjoy going to meetings, because lots of meetings, especially at the kind of school level, can be a little bit laborious, but I actually really enjoy going to these departmental tutor forums. So this is where all of the departmental tutors across the school get together to discuss issues that around bureaucracy, forms that we have to fill in, trying to make the process easier for us and easier for the students as well. But I mean, the content of the meetings can be quite banal, not particularly interesting. But what I do enjoy is coming across my counterparts from other departments and realizing that they're in different stages of their career. Some of them are professors, top of the game. Others are more like me, junior members of staff, listening to how different departments have kind of like totally different problems in terms of student issues or just a different student body altogether in some cases. So it's really interesting to see just how diverse the LSE is between departments. And I get to see that through my counterparts at these departmental tutor forums, which are quite enlightening, and sometimes you get a free lunch as well.
Can you now tell me about the third song you'll be taking with you?
Well, I think this third song is a little bit controversial. It's a cover, and it's also a cover of an amazing song, so people obviously get quite upset about that sometimes. The song is The Sound of Silence, which was originally by Simon and Garfunkel. Absolutely incredible in its original form, and that could easily have made my list as well. But I wanted to include this cover, which is by a band called Disturbed. They're an American heavy metal act. And I couldn't really believe it when I heard this song, because I instantly recognized the guy's voice, David Drayman, the lead singer of the band. Because I went through a kind of heavy metal goth phase, probably between the ages of about 16 and 20, when I was kind of my sixth form years and my undergraduate years in Sheffield. And this band, Disturbed, had an anthem of a song called Down With The Sickness, which probably is still played today in rock clubs. And I just remember it was the floor filler. Everyone would be down on the floor, moshing, jumping around in rock clubs like Corporation in Sheffield, or Subculture in Birmingham. And very fond memories of these really kind of like heavy metal rock clubs. I'm sure that some of them still exist, but they were really big up north and in Birmingham around the time that I was at university. So I think it's a great cover. Some covers absolutely destroy the original songs. Some covers can better the original songs, but this one is just different. It's a totally different interpretation of the song. His voice is absolutely incredible. I'm always attracted to vocalists, and vocalists are really good, kind of like almost, I think this guy might actually be classically trained. I think you can tell from the effort that he puts in and the kind of sound that he makes. So yeah, absolutely incredible. Rock tones, raspy, operatic. Really like this cover.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, as well as being a wildfire firefighter, you also do research in the area. Just to start, how does one become a wildfire firefighter?
By accident is the answer to that. My PhD was originally on air pollution in London. I was going to monitor air pollution in what we call urban canyons. So these are places where you've got tall buildings either side of each other, and the pollution from cars and buses can get trapped close to the ground, and it becomes very difficult for the pollution to kind of be removed from street level. But I very quickly realized that the equipment that I had to measure this pollution was not good enough, wasn't sensitive enough. And it was the cause of much anxiety in the first year of my PhD when I realized that the whole project was probably not viable. But fortunately, I got an opportunity to go to Canada and Australia in the first year of my PhD, because the equipment that I was using for monitoring pollution in London was also very good at measuring the constituents of smoke from wildfires, the gases that are in the smoke. Now, the thing that was really helpful is that smoke is much, much, much more polluting than the kind of stuff that we see in a canyon in London. So actually the instrument was by far sensitive enough to measure all the stuff in the smoke from a wildfire. And after, you know, a number of field trips, once to Canada and twice to Australia, you know, I managed to collect a really good and rich data set from these wildfires, and no one had used this type of equipment before for measuring the smoke from wildfires. So I realized that actually I should probably just change the focus of my PhD and focus on this amazing data set that I just collected. And so it was just by chance, by luck, really, that I happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right skills. And I did. I changed the focus of my PhD. I returned to Australia a few times to get some more data, and was able to put together a number of chapters on smoke and what influences smoke, whether it's the type of soil that's burning, the type of vegetation that's burning, how it's burning, you know, the intensity of the fire, how that affects what's in the smoke, all of these things. So it was really about having the skills to operate this piece of equipment that happened to be really good at measuring smoke. The rest is history then. I developed the technique. That was the whole focus of the PhD. And what it has enabled is us to make measurements of smoke in places that previously were inaccessible. So before I demonstrated the use of this technique, which can be used beside a fire, so in situ, in the middle of the smoke, the only way to make measurements of what was in smoke was to collect samples and then take them to a laboratory. And you'd have to do that really quickly. And in some remote parts of the planet, that's really difficult. And often they don't have the labs that are capable of analyzing the samples. Mm. Or you have to fly an airplane through the smoke. And that obviously costs a lot of money. And you have to have a very special airplane with all the right sensors on board. So we developed this technique that made it much, much easier to kind of measure smoke in situ at wildfires.
We're now moving on to your fourth song. Can you tell me what it is and any reasons why?
So this song has a great name. The name of the song is Great Gig in the Sky. And it's by Pink Floyd, which are absolutely one of the best rock bands of all time. Yeah, I suppose growing up, I missed out on the dad rock phase, listening to, you know, a lot of rock music. I know a lot of other people are influenced by their kind of dad's music taste. But when I moved back to Birmingham after my undergraduate degree, spent a lot of time with my stepdad, and he plays a lot of Pink Floyd. And a couple of years earlier, I'd been to Live 8 in London, which was like the big kind of like massive gig that featured Pink Floyd. And it was the only time in my lifetime that they played together as a four. Because shortly after the keyboard player died in 2008. So it was a very rare opportunity to see like one of the best bands of all time. They didn't play this song, but this is one of my favorite songs by Pink Floyd. It just starts with a very beautiful chord sequence. Pink Floyd can weave together chords. Sometimes the chord sequences are 15, 20 chords long. Most rock bands can cope with two or three or four maximum. But Pink Floyd are just kind of very musical. They were all classically trained musicians as well. So there is really something about their music that is, I'd say, quite sophisticated, complex chord sequences. Some of their music is in very complex time signatures as well, which is why it makes you feel edgy. They're really clever with the way they write their songs. But this one's incredible. Just beautiful chord sequence on the piano opening. And then really, I think it's a shame that this is called Pink Floyd, because the singer, Claire Torrey, is not a member of the band, but she absolutely steals the show in this song. It's a wild use of the voice as an instrument. There's no words. It's just wailing, and in some places screaming. And it's very much stormy. It's a beautiful song to listen to when you're on a train, I don't know, going up the northeast coast of England, waves crashing against the side of the shore, and you hear this music. It's just really evocative of a storm. And there's a bit of a controversial conspiracy theory that this album, Dark Side of the Moon, again, one of the best rock albums of all time, can be played alongside the start of the Wizard of Oz film. Now, I don't know if you've heard about this rumor, Will. I'm an advocate of this conspiracy theory. I think it works. And this song, The Great Gig in the Sky, appears at the time in the film when the twister, the tornado arrives in Kansas. And the length of the song is exactly the same length as that scene in the film. And even the wailing seems to kind of reflect what's happening on the screen in the film, with Dorothy being smacked over the head by her window and then passing out before arriving in Munchkin Land.
So what is the best way to put out a wildfire, from the expert?
Well, that depends on many things. So this is what I learned when I did my wildfire firefighter training, when I got my qualification in Catalonia a few years ago. So it does depend on the size of the flames. So if the flames are small, kind of knee to chest height, well, maybe just knee height, it's possible to do direct attack. And the best form of direct attack is to beat the fire. So you'd use a beater to waft it down and to make sure that the fire doesn't have any access to oxygen. Flames that are slightly larger, so kind of chest height to shoulder height, beating is no longer an option because you're going to get burnt. And this now requires another form of direct attack. So you'd use water, hose pipe, if you have it available, but that's very difficult in remote wildland fire environments. So that's often not an option. As you get to larger flames, it's not possible to use direct attack at all. And so you need to use indirect or defensive attack. And that might include removing vegetation ahead of the fire. So using bulldozers or rakes. So I spend a lot of time in my firefighter training using a rake to rake the ground and to remove all of the leaves and the needles from trees. And if you create a barrier by removing the vegetation, you can stop the fire because you've removed the fuel. So that's a form of indirect attack. The most exciting form of indirect attack that I learned on this training course was to use fire. So once you've removed the vegetation and created a barrier, you then actually set a fire on the side of the barrier that's facing the fire that's approaching. And slowly those fires come together and then put themselves out because there's no more vegetation to burn. So that's the classic fighting fire with fire technique. Of course, there's aerial attack as well for the largest of fires where you drop water, but that's something that's generally beyond the capabilities of the UK Fire and Rescue Services. They don't have a dedicated tanker aircraft or helicopter or anything like that.
Well, I never would have thought about fire with fire.
Yeah, obviously the main fire that you're trying to stop has been driven by the wind mostly. So that's a much bigger fire. But the fire that you set is going to go against the wind slowly. And that's how you can keep it controlled. You just have to make sure that the fire that you set doesn't jump across the barrier that you've just built and start a new fire on the other side. That's the kind of thing that you really have to make sure that doesn't happen.
Well, Tom, it's now time for your fifth song. Can you tell me what it is and if there's any reasons why you've chosen it?
Yeah, well, I moved to London in 2007 for my master's degree at King's College. And I suppose that was the time that I was really beginning to develop my own taste in music. I was less influenced by my friends, like with the rock and goth music, and by my parents with the kind of classic rock and things like that. And I got really interested in kind of like the Scandinavian electronic music scene. So artists like Robin, Royksopp, Fever Ray were kind of like, I was really into all of this kind of like Scandinavian electronic music. And I discovered this singer, Molly Nielsen. I think it was through a website. This is like before Spotify. There was a website called Audio Scrobbler. I think it's now called Last FM, still exists. And it would track what you listen to on your MP3 collection and then would kind of recommend artists. And I started going to all these small gigs in London, like Bethnal Green Working Men's Club, Moth Club, Servant Jazz Quarters, Electric Ballroom in Camden, often by myself. And this artist really blew me away when I saw her live, Molly Nielsen. She has this wonderful song called Hey Moon, which is the track that I've selected for this fifth song. And I also think like this is a nice song to be listening to on a desert island. It's like the lyrics like, hey moon, it's just you and me tonight. Everyone else is asleep. It's all about kind of isolation and having this relationship with the moon. And so, you know, really beautiful lyrics, simple song. It's completely the opposite of Pink Floyd. It's just very basic drum machine and a synthesizer, lo-fi kind of genre. And I got really into this and still am into these bands and will often go and, we'll normally go and see them on a free on quite a regular basis, but not since lockdown.
Do you have a favorite dish you like to eat?
The problem is in lockdown, I've been doing lots and lots of cooking and I've been learning lots of new recipes and trying to think of the one that I'm most proud of. And I think it's a very simple dish. It's the Som Tam salad, which is a Thai salad made using papaya. And I always thought it'd be very difficult to make, but actually it's incredibly simple. It's probably very difficult to make it well.
I don't know anything about, aren't salads, don't you just chop it up? And what's hard about this one?
Well, it's like there's the right balance between the flavors. So that's what's like, I much prefer other people to make it for me because they can, I've had some amazing papaya. It's a papaya salad, sometimes made with mango, but then it's not really the same thing. But yeah, it's the right balance between like the sweetness from the papaya, making sure that the papaya is not too ripe as well. There's chilies, so it has to be hot and spicy, but not too hot and spicy that it dominates. There's a fish sauce that you can add. And again, making sure that it's not too fishy. Otherwise, again, that overpowers. It's about like having the right balance of flavors. And that's probably my favorite food. And I've attempted to make it in lockdown. It's not quite been as good as what I've tasted on my travels. But yeah, I'll stick with the Som Tam salad. Also, it's normally topped with nuts as well, which adds like a texture to it. So you've got all these mixture of flavors and textures, which is really great.
You've not made it sound easy, but post-lockdown, I'd love to give that a try. But we're now moving on to your sixth song. Can you tell me what it is and any reasons why?
Yeah, this is related to travel, actually, so it's come at the right time. I have a playlist on my Spotify that is automatically made by Shazam, So whenever I Shazam a song, it gets added to this playlist. And over time, I've been doing this for like 6 years now. It's like an audio diary of places that I've been, because every single song will remind me of the place I was when I held up my phone to do the Shazam. And so it's like a record of my travels. So it's full of songs from Indonesia, from Malaysia, from India, when I've been running the trip with my undergraduate students to India. So I've got all of these different songs from different parts of the world. Also just, you know, good songs I've heard on the radio when I've been in a, you know, just at home or with my parents, things like this. So I love going to this playlist, because it reminds me of my travels, and I've got so many songs from fieldwork in here, and it just brings back good memories. So this is one of the first songs in this playlist that goes back a really long time to when I was first beginning to develop a project in Indonesia in collaboration with the University of Indonesia. And I remember being sat in a taxi in Jakarta. It was before they'd opened up the rail link that connected the city to the airport, and the only way to get into town was in a taxi, and the traffic was absolutely atrocious. I think that it was a 3-hour taxi ride. I was just sat still for a long time before I got to meet this professor at the University of Indonesia. And this song came on the radio, and I thought it was really, like, just had a great sound. And so I Shazammed it, and it's there as a record. And that's when I was sat in that taxi in Jakarta. Yeah, it's probably one of my favorite songs by an Indonesian band. It's called Main Hati, which translates, I think, to kind of like playing with my heart. It's a classic love song. It's by a rock band called Andra and the Backbone. And it is one of, it's also a go-to karaoke song for me. So when you do karaoke in Malaysia in particular, it's often custom to sing songs in multiple languages, because Malaysia has a very diverse population. People who speak different Indian languages, people who speak Chinese, both Mandarin and Cantonese. Obviously, there's the Malay language as well, and the Indonesian language, which is slightly different. And so when you do karaoke, you'll often have a whole mixture of all of these different languages. So this is the one I go to if I'm going to try and sing something in the Indonesian language.
If you could go back in time 5 years, is there anything you wish you could tell yourself?
5 years.
That would take us to 2015.
Yeah, that's not a huge amount of time, you know. I probably know what I would say to myself if I could go all the way back to my A-level years.
And what would that be?
I was always split between music and geography. It was a really difficult decision to make, to choose to do geography at university and not music. And I always was worried that I would regret it. And I got very stressed out about that choice. I enjoyed both, but I probably realized that I was not as talented as some of my other A-level music cohort, and realized I'd probably struggle. So I did choose geography in the end. I actually chose to do human geography at university. And I was always worried that I would kind of regret that. And so I'd probably tell myself that don't stress out. There are going to be ways for you to keep music in your life still. It's not like you're going to be turning your back on music. There are always lots of ways you can keep it as an extracurricular activity. Something like that.
Can you now tell me about the 7th song you were taking with you?
Yeah, I really wanted to include some classical music. Classical music's always been fairly important, especially doing like the A-level in music. And I really actually enjoyed the kind of history of music side of things and the classical elements of the GCSE and A-level. And I've become really into minimalist classical music, which is, I find it's really great for work, for relaxation. And I found it really difficult to pick a particular piece. I mean, I really like the genre. And so I found it quite hard to pick a piece. I like, composers like Philip Glass, Steve Reich, John Adams, Arvo Pärt, Niels Frahm, all of these people. But I decided to go with, a piece by Meredith Monk, It's a modern opera. I think it's from the 1990s, early 1990s. And it's called Atlas. So it's geographical. And this movement is actually called Earth Seen from Above, which is a bit like kind of using satellites to look at the Earth. And it's a beautiful piece. It's for mostly for a cappella, so just voice only. And I thought, like, if I'm stranded on a desert island, I think it'd be really nice to hear the sound of human voices. And again, it's like some of the other tracks that I've selected. There's no words, there's no lyrics. It's just noises. It's using the voice as an instrument, a bit like the Pink Floyd track and the Louis Armstrong track, where Louis Armstrong's kind of like improvised singing. Whereas this is very carefully crafted music, very complex kind of harmonies and rhythms. And so I just think it's beautiful. I actually listen to this sometimes when I'm looking at satellite images. It's like it kind of makes my skin tingle, gives me goosebumps. And yeah, I could have selected a whole number of kind of pieces of classical music from this era, the 80s and 90s, but have gone with this one by Meredith Monk.
What's your favorite thing about being at the LSE?
Well, obviously it's the students. And I'm not joking. It's the obvious one. Very much the students. The students played such an important part in attracting me to the job at the LSE, because I'd been a class teacher for a number of years on GY120. I could see the level of the student, the engagement, the fact that I would get pushback. You know, I would explain something and then a student would say, well, how about this? Or had you not thought about this? Oh, well, actually I read this paper that said this. And to be put on the spot is just a great challenge. And I think all of us as academics really enjoy that. And I encourage students to do that. So long as you're backed by evidence, of course. And that was a real kind of like eye-opener for me teaching LSE, because I really hadn't experienced that kind of engagement at other places that I taught. And also in my undergraduate program in Sheffield as well, it wasn't the way things were done. And to have students that can really kind of challenge you, and some students who I genuinely are able to work with collaboratively to produce new knowledge. Like I've just this week celebrating a paper that will be co-authored with a student is just fantastic. And it's a very rare quality that I think the LSE student body provides.
And now moving on to your eighth and final song, what is it and any reasons why?
So this is an artist that I've only come across recently, since lockdown, with the long days of boredom, of not being able to do much. I've been looking for some music that I can play, and looking for new kind of genres of music that I hadn't exposed myself to before. Weirdly, I've been listening a lot to kind of like religious choral music from the 17th century and stuff like this, because it's quite relaxing. And but this isn't religious choral music, fortunately. This is an artist called Baden Powell de Aquino. He's a Brazilian guitarist. And I really like this particular piece. It reminds me of a sea shanty. So again, it's got links to the geography island. I can imagine being sat on a hammock, lying on a hammock, listening to this beautiful music, sea shanty-esque. I mean, Baden Powell was a genius of bossa nova, jazz styles. But this piece in particular is less jazzy and more kind of sea shanty. And it always amazes me that it's just one person playing the guitar when I hear these pieces, because it sounds to me like it needs four hands or something like that. But just incredible, and definitely my favorite find of lockdown when it comes to music. So I wanted to include that as my final song.
So now moving on to the last part. So you're allowed to take with you the Bible, the Beveridge Report, and a book of your choice. What book are you going to be taking with you?
So I'm going to select, and I don't think this is cheating, Will, because I know you're not allowed to take an item that helps you escape the island, but I'm going to take a book that helps me escape the island. The book is called The Natural Navigator by Tristan Gooley. And I read this a number of years ago, and it's a book about navigation, about how to find your way around without using any tools. So no compass, no map, no GPS, just the landscape and the sky. And through learning about navigation using these techniques, you also learn a lot about the land and about nature and about astronomy. And I found it a really fascinating book when I read it the first time around. And I'd love to read it again because I've probably lost all of that knowledge that I read the first time around. And I thought it might be very useful if I was stranded on a desert island, because I might actually be able to figure out a way of finding out where I am, the latitude and longitude, and the direction that I might need to go in if I was to try and escape. So I think this book is great. It starts off with the first chapter is simply, which way am I looking? You know, to teach you about, you know, how to find north and south and things like that. But then it gets into much more complex navigational skills that help identify exactly where you are and what time it is and things like this. So thought it would be very useful on a desert island.
I think there probably is a rule somewhere how you're not allowed books to help you as well.
No, I checked. I checked on Wikipedia. The rule is only applies to the item. So, and this is simply knowledge that I'll be gaining by reading the book.
Yeah, and to be fair, it's a geography and environment podcast. I feel this could slide even if there was. If you're claiming there wasn't, I'll take your word on that.
Okay, bending the rules. I don't think it. I don't think I'm breaking any rules.
It's fine. I'll give it to you. I'll let you have the book. And then now moving on to your luxury item. What is it?
Yeah, I suppose it's obvious given our chat, but I would like to take a piano. And I know this is the most popular item on the BBC's Desert Island Discs program, but I just think I'd be lost without one. It's something that I go to when I want to, when I'm struggling with things. I'd be able to accompany myself singing. So useful for many reasons.
And perfect. And then I guess, thank you, Tom, for telling me about your geography island jams.
Thanks, Will.